Succession number 28411, Reel 7.
So what did you report back?
Well, I reported back that these three blokes were killed, three ORs, and Bill Graydon. And I suppose about a quarter or half an hour later, up came Bill Graydon up the track, staggering. He didn't know what day of the week it was. He was obviously stunned. And I should have really checked that he wasn't dead, but I didn't. Thought he was dead. Anyway, up came Bill, and of course that's the last we saw of him for a while. He was badly concussed. On we went. And the other time of this, the same area, Uriah Ridge, we had a little pillbox with four or five blokes on the top of the hill, like we had a good view of looking down the track. And I had to take them over Tucker and whatever. And it was a bald spot, not much bigger than this room, really, and I suppose that sort of distance from cover there to this place here. And I went over, I remember, with something they wanted, I can't remember.
So about 15 feet away.
Yeah, that's sort of, yeah, probably a bit more than that. But I had to run the gauntlet because there's no jungle there. And obviously the Japs could saw me go over and lined up this mountain gun. Well, I'm assuming this would happen. And on the way back, they let fly. And I heard this damn thing go over my head. I don't know whether it was that far or up to the ceiling. It was pretty close. I heard it anyway. And, of course, it didn't affect me. But it went over the ridge and landed in brigade headquarters and killed the eye sergeant, who chaplain named Riley Lamb, landed right on him, cleaned him up. He'd be considered pretty unlucky back there at brigade headquarters with a dirty big hill mountain in between them. But at any rate, poor old Riley got knocked off. And it was a very vicious gun, really was.
You were mentioning earlier on that, you know, you sort of think, well, I was better than me, and thank God I'm alive when my mate's dead. In this scenario where you're literally lying head to toe,
behind a tree,
yeah. when three of your comrades go all at once and their remains literally splattered over you, how does that strike someone like that?
Look, you can wonder now what it'd been like, but at the time you're in that sort of an environment. That's the world you're in, and it didn't. You say, oh, thank God I'm alive. That didn't even occur. I don't know how other blokes felt, but I suppose we're all human, all the same. I just want to report back what had happened, you know, and you don't sort of stop and think, oh, Jesus, I'm here and they're not here and all that. You don't think that way there. I don't think I'm no any different from anyone else. I don't know, it's hard to explain. But I know when we got out, or when I was carted out really from Gona, I didn't know how badly wounded I was, but I said, oh, I'm going to be out of that lot for a while, you know. You think that way then. But no, it's a funny feeling. I certainly can't describe it.
Well, here
you know, a lot of blokes, I think, exaggerate a bit. You know, I read them in the papers and so forth. But there you go, and here we are.
Here you are. You've got these bloody heavy rifles that you've...
No, a Tommy gun, yeah. The ammo is the heavy part, but right. A Tommy gun. Only a little short nose thing.
Well, tell us what it's like to fire a Tommy gun in the jungle.
Oh, pretty bloody good. It's a Tommy gun. It's got a single shot. It's got a very short range because of it's a little stub-based thing. It's a semi-machine gun. Yankee. Now you can adjust a little lock on it and you can spray. Instead of, you know, bang, bang, bang like that individually. And of course in the jungle it's all you have with a bloody, you know, shoot there, you spray the bloody thing. And it's very effective. But you get through a lot of ammo. That's why I carry a lot. But it's to have a rifle in the jungle is absolutely ludicrous, really. It's heavy, it's large, it's cumbersome, and you know, you've got to bang and then reload it and bang, and you don't have time. With a Tommy gun, you can spray, you don't know where the bastard is, but he's in there somewhere, you give it a good spray. With a rifle, you can't. Yeah. Hopeless.
Presumably not everyone had a Tommy gun.
No. I can't really say who else went, but I know I had one, and I can't for the life of me tell you how I got it, but I had it in the Middle East after a while. I didn't get it. Well, I was a corporal then, and probably all corporals, which are section leaders, got a Tommy gun, I presume. I really can't remember how I got it, but I wasn't the only one. But the average bloke had rifles, 303s, World War One vintage, and they were totally. I mean, they talk about bayonet charges, etc. in the jungle, but you didn't. Just too heavy having a bayonet. Chuck it away. I mean, if I'm going to bayonet charge you, surely it's better to bloody old stick a bullet in you 10 yards away than wait until you get up colour of his eyes. It's just hopeless. But that's how they. Basically, we were armed and understand this.
The average Japanese soldier, presumably better equipped.
I don't know what they had. They had a much lighter rifle. I really don't know what. I think they probably had modern. I've never thought about that, actually. It's certainly a small.
So you're mentioning the Japanese had a small rifle?
Yeah. I presume it was a Japanese rifle, but it would have been a lot lighter. A 303 was. You know, 1914-18 job, really. It was totally inadequate, in my opinion.
But your clothing wasn't really suited, either.
No, well, as it turned out, we were in Middle East khaki shirts and shorts, but we didn't know any different. I mean, the only difference would be now, I think the jungle, what they call the jungle khaki, but they weren't in vogue then. Never heard of them.
You hear stories of people actually dying there.
Dying know, where?
Dyeing their uniforms.
Never heard of it.
The colour of
I didn't. I think towards the end of the war. I don't know. Look, I got wounded going on. It was the end of my war.
Yeah.
Now, what happened up in the Roma Valley or Tarakan, I don't know. I think from memory, they may have had jungle greens, not the camouflage ones, I think. I think I may have seen some when I was back in Sibby Street seeing some blokes.
But here you are, trudging through the jungle in hobnailed boots, I understand.
There was no problem there. Oh, he couldn't have gone through them sand shoes, really, to make a comparison. Nothing wrong with hobnailed boots. I mean, we were so used to them. We could dance in them. We were so used to them. In fact, I remember when I first got out of the hospital here, I got charged with that. I took off the boots and wore civvy shoes. And you're not allowed to do that. Officers could do it. But I was a sergeant. And I got taken in front of the beak. It was fortunately an ex-officer from our battalion. He squashed it. But no, the boots were, we got so used to them. And you'd have to have those boots in the jungle. You'd have to.
The Japanese had what they call monkey boots or
I don't know what they had. I don't know. It went through my mind what they had, but I really don't know. I'm sure they would have been boots of some sort.
Separate big toe, apparently.
Huh?
They had a sort of separate big toe.
No, I don't know about that.
Right.
Don't know about that. No, I didn't see any Japs, you know, close up in the understandings. I saw them in Gona. But they were the same bloody Japs.
Well, right, let's talk about that experience in relation to Gona.
Well, we got came out of Owen Stanley's, the 16th took over from us. The 16th Brigade, yeah. 1st Battalion. We came out, and I was seconded to the 1st Brigade. They were going up there the next day, and I was supposed to go over there and spend a day and a night telling about jungle warfare. And I did that, and we were camped a place called Aitiki Maruna, I don't know what it was, alongside a beautiful fresh stream, anyway. And about half a dozen of us were up for commission. Our papers had gone in, and we were taught not Morse code, a
semaphore.
Now, why? I suppose it would have been something. It seems old fashioned now, but I think probably to keep us occupied. And gradually our numbers grew up. Blokes coming back from walking wounded, you know, some are better. Chaps had gone down with malaria. And we got to our strength was all back to about half, I suppose. Don't really know, but I know that built up. And by the time the brigade, the 16th Brigade and the 25th and all the others had pushed the Japs back, they were had our problems. Then they were right at the extremity. They were pushed back. They were buggered. So we were then flown over there to relieve them.
Let's talk then about what it was like flying off to help the others.
And we landed, I think, when we flew over the ranges and landed at an airstrip at a village called Popondetta. When we got off the plane, it was like going to a brick oven, really. It was absolutely entirely flat, and as I recall, the entire coastal plain, as it was, it was covered in kunai grass, which was a very razor leaf type of thing, about 6 or 8 foot tall. I know I could pretty well stand up and not be seen. I'm 6 foot three. At any rate, it was very, very hot and very, very steamy, and lots of swampy marshes around. And we were, of course, full battle gear, and off we marched. We knew we were going to Gona, but we didn't have a clue where Gona was in relation to where we landed. And we marched and we marched and we marched. And we went through the only civilization I remember was going near or through a small village called Saputa. And we were heading in a north-easterly direction. And we arrived about dusk, I suppose, and we would have been just south of Gona, and I don't remember taking over any of our own troops, but I know they were there, but you don't, you feel the vision's not very far. So we just slept the night where we dropped, actually, and an attack was planned to go up the village and see as far, I suppose, to see how far we could go at dawn next morning, which of course we lined up. Wasn't much we were told about. We just got up and lined up and went line, I've forgotten what the army term was now, in a straight line anyway, through the kunai grass, and it wasn't long before the Japs started firing on us, and I didn't see a Jap, not then, and we received quite a few were wounded, blokes were killed, I got off scot-free, but in any event, probably I would guess through lack of knowledge by the winds that powers to be that planned the attack. It soon broke up, and we retreated and spent the rest of the day trying to recoup and plan for the next day. Well, the next day was the... I've forgotten the dates anyway. The next day, it was planned, we were told, that we would attack the village again. And this time, we could see the village. It was up in a bit of raised ground, no doubt, to keep out of the swamp and water and so forth. And that's where the Japs were dug in. They had got two or three of our 25-pounders from somewhere, probably Milne Bay, I don't know, where they got them. First time I'd seen them anyway. And we, our platoon, our company, the company didn't consist of much, but the 16th were to be at a certain forward position just before dawn, and we would, the artillery would give us a covering fire. And once that artillery barrage was lifted, we were head down and tail up into the village. Alan Hattie, who had been spoken of earlier, was the other side of the village and was to give us supporting fire. He was with Char Force. And there was an attack up the beach, I think. It was the 2nd, 14th, I'm not sure of that, which is on our right, on the ocean side, and on the left was the 2nd, 27th, South Australian Battalion. And that was the plan, anyway. Up, we were in position and sat waiting. The barrage opened up, and they dropped the 25-pounders on the village. But unfortunately, one of them was a drop short. It had a funny noise, a drop short. I'd never heard it before or since, and I don't want to. But it's a sort of a ooh, as it spins over. It's not a, something's gone wrong with the shell or the, it wasn't a true shot. Anyway, it landed right in amongst us. It killed three other blokes. We were lying in the Kuniar grass and we were chatting together, so they weren't that far away. They all got killed and all I got was a shower of dirt. Probably knocked out, made a bit silly, but I went floundering around trying to find out if they were all right or wounded, or I got no reply, couldn't find them. And the attack went on. I was completely by myself. I didn't know where the rest of the platoon was, but I know the battalion went into the village, and they got right through the village, actually. The Japs were just too well dug in, and they were under cover of wog huts and so forth. And the attack just didn't succeed. They ran right through and into the swamp on the other side. Those had got to the village and eventually swam the swamp and got to where round about where Alan Hattie was, I think. I don't really know what happened there.
The 3rd of December. The 2nd 14th Battalion.
What's that, the 3rd?
The 3rd of December.
No, this will be the 1st or 2nd I'm talking about. Anyway, yeah.
You mentioned that you were to be checked by swamps. In relation to the position of the Japanese, I understand that they were, as you mentioned, dug in.
Yeah, we just knew they were there. You couldn't see them. They were dug in. I didn't get into the village, I just mentioned. but I know the blokes, I was told afterwards, subsequently, that one or two of them charged some dugouts with the Japs in and had a go at them. But they're pretty fanatical, these slit eyes. And we just didn't have enough troops to defeat them.
General Douglas MacArthur had ordered the bases at Gona and Boona to be overrun as soon as possible.
Oh, yeah.
How was he seen, MacArthur?
How was he seen from us?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's in hindsight that I can comment on how he is seen, but We knew about blaming in Kirkcaldy because he came and told us. But MacArthur, I don't recall hearing much about him. He was too high up. But we, you know, we've known afterwards from blokes who were there and who were told and books that he was, you know, couldn't understand, like, I think Blamey was copied from him, why the hell we weren't winning and getting rid of the Japs. But he wasn't there, had no idea. I don't know whether he ever got to New Guinea, I suppose he did. But I'll come to the Americans later, a little bit later. But I staggered off. I must have been looking back a bit, you know, concussed. And I remember running into some 2 or 3 second 27th Battalion who were over on our left. And I said, well, where the 16th Battalion headquarters is? And they showed me. And I remember seeing a few of their dead still lying there, and a few Japs too were dead, so obviously they had been fighting there, dead Japs. And I eventually got to battalion headquarters about 1 o'clock. I know it was 1 o'clock, because as soon as I arrived and reported in and reported who the blokes were killed, I was sergeant. They grabbed me for another attack. And this attack was to go... the Japs were holding us up right on the beach and inland towards where our headquarters were. And a mixed bunch of blokes who were ever available, I think, were organised for a charge straight down the beach to try and cut off the Japs who were holding up, I think it was the 14th down there, held up. So we lined up, and there was only about 15 or 20 of us, that sort of number. Away we went. And there are obviously some bloody snipers around in the coconut trees. I'll be quite honest, I didn't see these snipers. You'd look for the damn thing if you couldn't see them. And I got knocked over 3 times, 3 bullets. And I got hit here in the face, was the last one. And I didn't know I'd been hit. I knew I'd been hit here and there. Blood was pouring down here. My cheek was open. I nearly yanked it off. Thank God I didn't. And I hopped in a Jap hole. The other blokes went on. We lost quite a few blokes there towards the beach. And a Jap foxhole came up to about there and me, little bastards. And a bit of dirt kicked up just behind me. I thought, God, I can't stop here. By this time, this leg was useless. So I counted 3 and looked up stairs and tried to scramble out, thinking I'd be, you know, any time now. And there were some blokes giving us covering fire behind a big tree about here, that house away, which is, 30 yards from me. And they sang out to me. Thank God they did. And I hopped, dragged, scrambled. Whether they had a shot at me, I don't know. But anyway, I chucked in behind there, and they looked after me, and they eventually... that was really the end of the war for me.
You've been shot in the leg and the chest, as well as the cheek.
Mm-hmm.
What did it feel like to know that?
Well,
you've been shot?
I remember the first one was the chest, and I just got a hell of a thump. I didn't realise then, I'd never been hit before. I didn't realise what it was. I remember it's just like a bloody mule kicking you, really. But I certainly knew about it when I got hit in the leg, because it... in this leg, it went. They had hit the Tommy gun butt. I don't know what the Tommy gun was doing down there. But it smashed that, and I think that might have saved the joint, because... but it certainly, you know, I couldn't walk on it before. Was it useless? And I didn't know about this one until I felt the blood running down. So I was really lucky in that regard. When the dirt kicked up here, God, I can't stop here. I couldn't see any up those palm trees, but they'd have to be there somewhere. They may have been on the ground. I didn't see a Jap. I believe none of our own blacks. The rest in that platoon, they may have, I don't know. Never bothered to find out. I know I didn't. And these blokes helped me back, or someone, behind the tree. I remember when it was Alf Robinson, the major. He was there. And they got me back, and all I can remember really is the being picked up, taken back to the battalion doctor, and then Fuzzy Wuzzies carted me back to wherever the forward dressing station was. And they operated on my leg that night. And I was sharing a camp with three other blokes. And one was, amongst others, one was our chap named Jock McDonald. He was in the First World War, an old Scottish fag. I don't think he's ever married. A real old hoary bloke. But anyway, he was there. He was our hygiene man. Now, the hygiene man's a bloke who looks after all the honeypots in camp and all the bloody sewage and little, you know, that side of it. And old Jock, I wonder what he's doing in there. I don't really remember. Just old age, I think. But he was in there, in the forward dressing station, which is a bush hospital. And he had a Japanese sword. That's right. And there was another American in the tent. There's only about six of us in it. And one of his American cobbers came in to see him. And old Jock was telling him about this sword, how he'd got off a dead Jap. And the Yank offered him $10, I suppose it was, for the sword. And silly old Jock gave her salt. Might have been a bottle of whiskey, I don't know. That sort of thing. I think it was $10. I wasn't feeling too bloody good. And I just sang out to Jock, "Hang on, old Jock." And he didn't. Now, we went from that dressing station next day by Fuzzy Wuzzy back to Popandetta, where the airstrip was to be flown back to the AGH and the And in the same tent, before getting on that thing, was this Yank with the Japanese sword. And another of his buddies came in. And you've got no idea the ruddy story, which is absolute crap, how he captured this ruddy thing. And true as I sit here, he paid $10 for it from old Jock McDonald. And, you know, that's just only a by-the-by, but these Americans were to take Buna, as we were to take Gona, and they just didn't advance 1 foot. I wasn't there, but it's absolute common knowledge. In fact, it's in books. MacArthur got so jacked, they just would not advance, because there's very few artillery there, but and MacArthur pulled them out. I think it was the 140th Regiment or something. Eigelberg was the OC or the CO. And they brought up one of the Australian battalions from Mill Bay, and they took Buna within a couple of days. But the Yanks just wouldn't put their heads up. And ever since then, I haven't had a high regard for their fighting qualities. I like them. All the machinery they have, but I don't know. They're all talking, not much action. That's my opinion.
People talk of the Australians being put in an almost secondary position to the American advance.
Say that again?
People have written that the Australians were placed in a secondary sort of mopping up position quite often in the latter part of the war.
What do you mean second? The Yanks were in there first.
The Yanks would go through, take all the best positions and leave you, the Australians, to sort of mop up
all the dirty work. Yeah, well, look, I can't answer that. I don't know. But I do know that was absolute common knowledge I can't say I was there because I didn't see it, but it was absolutely... Well, I've seen it read in books anyway.
At the time, was there any animosity between the Americans and the
Europeans? We didn't see them until then. I didn't. No, they just weren't there. They were American air... That's another thing. They were supposed to... When we were in their own Stanleys and living on hard tucker, bully beef, they were supposed to... Biscuit bombers, we used to call them. I don't know what sort of planes they were. Fly over to wherever a lot of place was, Myola mainly, I think. Drop these bully beef and biscuits. That was our rations. And these bastards, I've seen it, so I'm not still making it up, would drop the bloody thing not where close to us. They'd come over pretty low down. But they'd drop it about a mile away from us, in the jungle, and not only would they all split when they fell, that was a bit of bad luck, but we just never got them. You couldn't go through the jungle and find it. No one could, you get lost.
This is the third reel of a taped interview with Pell Williams in his home in Perth.